Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the center's director, Ann Stevens. This series brings scholars and policy experts from around the country to discuss their work on poverty and poverty research. In April 2012, we hosted Janet Shim, an assistant professor of sociology and nursing at the University of California, San Francisco. Her ongoing research examines how epidemiologists conceptualize and use race, socioeconomic status, and sex or gender in their work, and how lay people think about the effects of social differences on their health. Here is Shim presenting her seminar, Social Inequalities in Healthcare Treatment.
So thank you so much for the invitation to come and speak with you today. It's really a pleasure. First, I just want to ask for a little bit for your indulgence. This is a bit of a work in progress. These are sort of ideas and reflections and based on empirical work, but these are ideas that I've kind of been working out for the past several months and going forward into the future. And Ming Chen said that that was permissible in this kind of a seminar. So I know, as was said, we have an interdisciplinary audience. So I'd be really curious and would love to hear how what I'm going to share with you today, you know, to what extent it travels in other kinds of disciplines and other social institutions and social worlds that you all are engaged in doing research in. So I'm really looking forward to comments and questions and discussion during the Q&A. So thanks. I also need to acknowledge two very important people. Jamie Chang and Leslie Dubin are my collaborators on this project, and they're graduate students, but very full collaborators in every sense of the word. So my thanks obviously goes out to them. So I want to start off, first of all, by taking a poll. How many of you have either yourself been a patient in our healthcare system or have had a loved one who was a patient in the healthcare system? And by patient, I mean going for outpatient services, clinic visits, in a hospital, any of that.
When you say our system, you mean UC Davis?
I'm sorry? No. The U.S. healthcare system.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyone's hands not go up? Okay. One person? Okay. So this, your experience as a patient is something I kind of want to ask you to keep in the back of your head as I'm going to go through my talk. And for me, this project is very much personal as it is academic, and so I'm hoping that by drawing on your own personal experiences as patients in our healthcare system, you'll be able to make some connections and relate to what I'm talking about. So I mentioned that this project is personal as well as academic, and I want to talk a little bit about why, how I came to this project and why it matters to me, why I care about it. So about 10 years ago, or a little over 10 years ago now, when I was working on my dissertation, I was interviewing people of color who had been diagnosed with heart disease. And for the most part, I was asking them about their causal accounts of heart disease. So what they think put them at risk in terms of their health, why they thought that they had gotten cardiovascular disease in the first place. And so our interviews were mostly about that kind of material. But all along the way, they kept bringing up their experiences in healthcare, about getting healthcare, about the healthcare they got and the healthcare they didn't or weren't able to get. And when they talked about these experiences, they would often use phrases like, it's so important to be able to learn things quickly. You have to have charisma. You need to be really savvy. You need to have confidence. You need to learn things quickly. And so all of those sorts of phrases, you know, even though my dissertation wasn't centrally focused on patient experiences, all of those phrases like just, you know, really echoed. And I ended up in my dissertation spending, part of one chapter looking at this notion that in the healthcare context, you need cultural capital. You need savvy and confidence and the ability to learn things and things like that. So that was 10 years ago, and about 5 years ago, this whole issue of how people navigate through and approach and encounter and experience the healthcare system and our unequal ability to do so successfully, that really became came home to me in an intensely personal way when my mother was diagnosed with stomach cancer. And you know, even though we had, you know, that whole experience really confirmed for me just how critically important it was that you learn things quickly, that you try to be as savvy as possible, that you, like, walk that really fine line between being assertive and yet not too assertive, that you have to accrue a whole host of other skills, like, in really short order, in order for my mom to get the care that we felt she needed and that she deserved. So that really put, there's nothing like a personal experience to put the fire in your belly, to like go and figure something out, to go do research on something. And so that really motivated me to go back to some of the ideas that I had just begun to work out in my dissertation and to really do something more with it. And so part of what I'm going to share with you today is some of the additional thinking and some empirical work that I've done in the ensuing 5 years. So then fast forward to the present, and I really want to emphasize that I think it's as important as ever to understand at a deeper level what it takes for individuals to access quality and to access and receive quality health care. So recent events, of course, have a whole lot to do with this. In 2010, the landmark Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, or the ACA, or Obamacare, or any number of other, you know, ways that it's been referred to, it put in place a number of fundamental changes to our nation's healthcare system. That last graphic, you know, the one that says, like, upheld in 2012, of course, that's a reference to the Supreme Court decision that that validated much of the content of the Affordable Care Act. I don't actually think, like, Barack Obama's actual signature was, like, stamped over. It was just a graphic, I think, that, you know, people put up to make the point, a sort of in-your-face point about, you know, look, it's done, it's passed, it's going to happen. So the ACA, what exactly does it include? Obviously, a huge amount of attention and media was rightly placed on its provisions to expand access to insurance and to care, but a whole lot less visible and a whole lot less controversial aspects of the ACA include measures institutionalizing what has come to be known as patient-centered care. So some of these measures include the establishment of a patient-centered outcomes research institute. Does that click happen? Here we go. A patient-centered outcomes research institute, or PCORI, to compare the clinical effectiveness of medical treatments, the development of a national quality improvement strategy to improve the delivery of healthcare services, the encouragement of pilot projects to test something called patient-centered medical homes, and the establishment of a community-based collaborative care network program to support coordinated services for low-income, uninsured, and underinsured populations. So altogether, the ACA codifies and legitimates patient-centered care as the primary means through which to pursue the so-called triple aim, and the triple aim consists of getting improved health outcomes, obtaining better patient experiences, and lowering costs. And as we shall see, the codification of patient-centered care, or PCC, actually leads to an imperative that patients be activated, engaged, and health literate. So in this presentation, I want to position cultural health capital, or CHC, as a sociological intervention as we embark on these changes aimed at making healthcare more patient-centered, and particularly for populations who are historically underserved by the existing system. So through the concept of CHC, I hope to illustrate how patient-centered care is accomplished or undone through these complex interpersonal and interactional work that's really highly dependent on access to stratified resources that both patients and providers bring to the healthcare interaction. So I'm going to be using data from, I'm going to give you some tidbits from a qualitative study that we've conducted. And using that data, I hope to show how both patients and providers' cultural assets, their dispositions, their interactional styles influence their abilities to achieve patient-centered care. So let me first provide a little bit of background into patient-centered care. And there's a companion notion of patient activation as well that I'm going to talk about. So patient-centered care is actually not that new. People have been tossing around the term and advocating for it for probably close to 30 years now. But the notion of patient-centered care really burst onto the public the health policy landscape in 2001 when the Institute of Medicine issued this landmark report called Crossing the Quality Chasm, right? So it's the implication is that there's a huge variability in quality. Not everybody is getting quality healthcare all the time, and that this report was all about how we're going to cross that quality divide. So in this report, patient-centered care was featured as one of six aims to achieve high-quality healthcare. So while there's some variability in what patient-centered care means and how it's defined, by most account, it aims to provide medical care that accords with a patient's cultural values, our needs, and our preferences. So in the literature, the constitutive domains of PCC include, one, understanding the patient within his or her biopsychosocial context, two, shared understanding, and three, shared power and responsibility. So let me just say a few words about each of these. Are there any more chairs or spaces to sit? No? Okay. All right. Sorry. So regarding the first domain, the biopsychosocial perspective, I mean, clearly there's a term where they try to glom everything into one hybrid term, right, hyphenated term. This biopsychosocial perspective recognizes the patient as a person who is influenced by their individual biography, their social context, and their cultural norms and beliefs. Thus, the meanings and significance of an illness will vary from person to person, and providers need to understand the patient's story of their illness and their expectations, feelings, and fears. So again, going back to the, you know, the poll where I asked people, have you been a patient in our healthcare system? Just think back to that when you're thinking about, when you're looking at each one of these three domains. So moving on to the second domain of shared understanding, this one refers to the patient and the provider coming together to a mutual sense of the clinical condition and the treatment options that are concordant with the patient's values, wishes, and beliefs. Achieving the shared understanding requires that the clinician frame and customize information in response to their understanding of a patient's concerns and needs. The clinician should also take account of a patient's level of health literacy and ability to understand and apply information to his or her clinical situation. And finally, we have shared power and responsibility. So there are some proponents of patient-centered care who will acknowledge that they're not sure whether we could ever get to a point where patient-provider relationships are completely symmetrical. But the general idea with the shared power and responsibility notion is that the patient and provider together create a therapeutic alliance. And so they jointly consider the patient's needs and preferences, which may change over time, right? We're not static. And that they deliberate together over what we imagine our future health to be, and then what kinds of treatment choices we want to make based on that. So the power and responsibility of making decisions about course of care are shared, allowing, in theory, for a consensus on an approach to care to be reached. So this all sounds easy, right? Super easy, no problem. Everyone who's been a patient in the system has experienced something like this. So as you can probably surmise, the rest of my presentation is going to try to unpack this black box and try to explain how complicated and how elusive this kind of endeavor is going to be. So back to patient-centered care and just its promise and how it's being talked about in the literature. So the aim of patient-centered care is, quote, to improve clinical practice by building caring relationships that bridge demographic, social, and economic differences between clinicians and patients. Now, a particular note to me and to those of you in the audience here, I think, is that PCC is really seen as a critical way to address health disparities and healthcare disparities. So one prominent group notes that, quote, patient-centered care is critical to addressing racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic disparities in care and outcomes. Patients who are ill, have low health literacy and numeracy, are members of marginalized groups, and have cognitive deficits tend to ask fewer questions and get less information than their peers without these obstacles. They are also less likely to understand technical and non-technical language. They go on to say, the practice of patient-centered care helps bridge differences among physicians and patients in health beliefs, race, ethnicity, and culture, and mitigates disparities in prevention and treatment. Yet, the contemporary healthcare landscape in which we have all experienced as patients, and in which patient-centered care is being implemented, is characterized by an emphasis on time and cost efficiency, as well as a real reduction in the range and kinds of ancillary services that we have access to. So just recall that patient-centered care is intended to address, remember that triple aim that I was talking about? So we have improved health outcomes, better patient care experiences, and lower costs. But in order to accomplish this, healthcare systems are increasingly interested in understanding how the patient's role, our role as patients, affects our healthcare experiences and how changes in our behaviors can improve health and reduce costs. So these incentives are driving the current policy emphasis on patient-centered care, both in healthcare policy and in healthcare provision. And in particular, the goal here is, in theory, to try to activate patients to be better managers of their own health and healthcare. So patient activation refers to, quote, patients' willingness and ability to take independent actions to manage their health and health care, with understanding one's role in the care process and having the knowledge, skill, and confidence to manage one's health and health care, patients have the skills and confidence to elicit what they need from their providers. So this activated, engaged, savvy, health-literate patient is seen as critical to the future health of the healthcare system and to the success of healthcare reform. So as many of you, I'm sure, can appreciate, if you're recalling back to when you were a patient, becoming and being this activated and engaged patient is no small task. So just in my own family's experience with my mom's cancer, we had a wealth of medical expertise. So my father, my sister, my husband all work in the medical field, or used to work in the medical field. So we had all of that, you know, medical expertise in our own family. We had a considerable amount of informational resources at our disposal, educational, cultural, interactional, other kinds of skills and advantages that we'd really drew on. Yet, even with all of these resources, even with all of these advantages, my experience was that we really found ourselves repeatedly struggling to articulate clearly what our questions and concerns were. Like, we didn't even know what questions to ask. We didn't know what we didn't know. And so it was really difficult to articulate, you know, what questions we needed to ask here. We found it difficult to make ourselves heard quite often. And we also found it really difficult to discern, like, what kinds of information we wanted and what exactly we needed and wanted from my mother's providers. So I also came to realize through this personal experience, and, you know, this is something that I suspected and heard from from the participants in my dissertation research before, but it really brought home to me just how consequential it was that these aspects of ideal patienthood, of being confident, of being savvy, of being knowledgeable, of being literate, all of those things, they're consequential because of how you mobilize them, how you display them, how they get recognized or not by the healthcare providers that you're seeing. And they're consequential because these processes play out and they have effects on the kinds of care and the amount of care, quite frankly, that we received. So I wanted to offer the concept of cultural health capital as a way to better understand how patients and providers engage with one another, how the outcomes of such interactions are mutually achieved, and whether, when, and if these outcomes reflect a patient-centered approach. So what I'm trying to argue today and what I hope to illustrate is that CHC, or cultural health capital, illuminates the complex interactional dynamics it takes to accomplish something called patient that looks like patient-centered care. And these interactional dynamics, their unfolding of them is really highly dependent on the kinds of specialized cultural resources and skills that both patients and providers bring to the clinical encounter. Okay, so what I want to do now is just walk you through what our definition of cultural health capital is and describe a little bit of the study in which we examined its operation, and then I'll move on to some of my reflections on what cultural health capital can say about patient-centered care. Okay. So in 2010, the year that Crossing the Quality Chasm and the Affordable Care Act, actually it was the Affordable Care Act was signed, I published finally my article on the concept of cultural health capital. And I did so because I wanted to offer it up as a potential framework to help account for how these interactional dynamics that I'm talking about that take place between patients and providers, how they may produce unequal treatment. So CHC is a concept that's rooted in the sociologist Pierre Bourdieu's theory of cultural capital. So Bourdieu came up with the notion of cultural capital after observing that the French public education system, rather than being an avenue for social mobility, in fact often worked to reproduce class inequality. And I'm sure for those of you who work in education or, you know, have read the papers about our public education system, we're finding the same thing in our country as well, right? So Bourdieu argued that this was because the reason why the public education system, in fact, contributed to inequality as opposed to contributing to social mobility was because success in school was predicated on what he called cultural capital. So Bourdieu defined culture not just as cultural objects like art or literature. It's not just beliefs and rituals that we engage in, but they're sort of the practices and the dispositions and the skills that we engage in, like every day of our lives. So these cultural practices operated as forms of capital, which, like economic capital, were important means of exchange in students' and parents' interactions with educational institutions. But because cultural capital is unequally distributed, the education system's demand for cultural capital for success in school served to maintain inequality. So consonant with Bourdieu, we theorize that both patients and providers activate, leverage, and deploy a whole slew of skills, competencies, resources, interactional styles that we term cultural health capital in order to effectively engage and interact with our providers, and that providers also use to interact with patients. And we hypothesize that what constitutes cultural health capital at this historical moment in our national context may include elements like medical knowledge and health literacy, this enterprising, proactive, instrumental attitude towards one's own health, and this ability to adapt one's interactional style. So as you can see, many of the elements of CHC include aspects of patient activation and engagement. But what the notion of cultural health capital points out is that some providers and patients have a great deal of these valued elements in their toolbox of skills, while others have much less. And because of these resources are a form of capital and they have exchange value in healthcare interactions, the stratified distribution of CHC shapes the kinds of relationships particular patients have with particular providers and for the kinds of medical care that is offered and received. And so we offer CHC as a framework that can augment the notion of patient-centered care by emphasizing interactional dynamics that both shape and surround the pathways through which patient activation impacts clinical encounters. That is, CHC is a concept that can help us to understand why patients and providers sometimes struggle to find common ground and a common language, and why engaging patients in their own care is a far more complicated affair than the definition of patient-centered care depicts. So the data that I'm drawing on here come from a qualitative study in which we aim to understand the elements of CHC and exactly how they operate in interaction. So we recorded clinic visits and we conducted separate in-depth interviews with patients and with physicians. And I could talk more about the methods in the Q&A if people are interested in this. So I want to move now to sharing with you three vignettes from our qualitative data. And through these vignettes, I want to make some observations about the relationship of CHC to PCC, of cultural health capital to patient-centered care. Okay. So one of the first arguments that I want to make, it has to do with something that Bourdieu called habitus, and this is sort of the last bit of like theory that we'll get before we get into the data. So Bourdieu, Bourdieu's notion of habitus, and of course Ming Chen and other people have written about this and studied this extensively. And in order to introduce the notion of habitus, I want all of us to sort of engage in a thought experiment here, and you know, maybe for some of you, like it was for me, this is, you know, much more reality, unfortunate reality, than it is a thought experiment. So here's a thought experiment. Imagine for a moment that you or a loved one has just been diagnosed with cancer. So you're sitting in the physician's office, and you've just been given the news. So a couple of questions for you then. What would you do first? Who do you want to talk to? What kinds of questions do you have? What do you want to know? And conversely, what don't you want to know? Where do you go to look for information? And what kinds of information do you look for? Would you be content to see a local specialist, or might you want to go elsewhere? Okay. So the actions that hopefully you all are imagining or, you know, recalling, taking, I would argue feel almost instinctual to all of us. It makes sense to us that we would, upon this being given this diagnosis, we would do X, Y, and Z. Okay? And this is what Bourdieu tries to get at with his notion of habitus. So he views human actors not as always deliberate and strategic individuals pursuing planned goals, but as possessing habitus, or general styles, habits, dispositions, and ways of thinking about, viewing, and being in the world. He argues that our general sensibilities about how the world works are deeply embodied, rooted in our past experiences, our socialization as children and as adults, and the kinds of worlds in which we have traveled throughout our lives. Habitus shapes the kinds of skills, styles, competencies, and resources that is the cultural capital that one possesses and acquires. And habitus, in Bourdieu's view, indelibly influences the direction, manner, and shape of all of our actions. So in the healthcare context, we argue that each patient and each provider involved in a clinical encounter possesses a specific habitus that guides our general styles of acting within that encounter. So as I was trying to show with the thought experiment, we very often pursue better health in largely habitual ways. And these ways are going to be rooted in our experiences, our long-lasting, lifelong ways of thinking and acting and organizing action, and our general sensibilities of how does the world work and how do I navigate through it. So as such, the ways in which patients and providers interact towards one another and the kinds of actions that we take to maintain our health are often hybrid combinations of purposeful actions and habitual embodied ways of thinking and conducting our lives. So what does patient and provider habitus mean for patient-centered care? So let me now introduce the first vignette from our qualitative study. So this vignette features a provider that I'll call Dr. Barrow. These are all pseudonyms, and his patient, Luis. First, let's hear from Dr. Barrow about how his communication style has changed over time. Quote, early on, you were kind of taught the way to do this was just sit there and ask open-ended questions and listen to everything somebody said. The biggest change over time has been the number of patients you see in clinic gets larger. You have less and less time, and I now frequently find myself trying to redirect patients. So I don't ask, how do you feel today? Because then you end up with a 20-minute speech about their cat. You try and get specific information that is relevant. I think people have to give me relatively little before I'll give them a lot more. If they speak in a manner that suggests that they're educated, if they know their medicines, a lot of it is based on how they are dressed, how they carry themselves, how they speak, what information they can give me, how thorough that information is, how relevant it is, how organized it is, things like that. So that's a pretty exhaustive list, right? Yeah. So Dr. Barrow is Luis's physician, and the relationship is one that actually seems really quite successful. So Luis is in his late 50s. He was born and raised in South America, and he immigrated to the United States as an adult. And he suffers from severe congestive heart failure and cardiac arrhythmias, where the rhythm of your heart is not regulated properly. When Luis first started getting sick, he quickly understood that part of the problem for him was that he could not clearly and efficiently articulate his medical and social history. So here's Luis talking now. Quote, "It's my English. I need help because I heard what you say, but I still have some kind of problem to comprehend it, what you ask of me. I have a problem for reading. My teachers used to hit my head and pull my ears. Are you stupid? And this caused a problem for my learning skills. Now, imagine to learn English. I forget things. That's the other that comes with the learning disability. The more I get older, I forget things very easily. If you ask me a lot of questions, I have difficulty to answer exactly." So to bridge this gap in his own abilities, Luis has enlisted the help of his close friend Anna, who possesses myriad cultural resources from which Luis derives benefit. So here's Dr. Barrow speaking again about their interaction. Quote, "Luis would probably drive me crazy, except for the woman, Anna, who comes in with him, who has everything in line and is so on top of things. She comes in with a notebook. She can tell you anything you want to know. She has enough medical knowledge to kind of understand the importance of record keeping and following up with things. If he were by himself, I think it would be a very different story. He's like a free spirit, artist, musician, kind of dresses all wacky, and he's fun to talk to, but it would be harder for him to manage his medications and things like that by himself. I think if I was only working with him, getting him on the phone and getting him to show up to things, anything like that would be much more difficult. Anna is not medically sophisticated necessarily, but she is so organized and so put together and takes such good care of him that it's very rewarding to take care of him. Interacting with him is very pleasant. If I was dependent on him for medical decisions, that might be a different story. So between the two, you get a lot done, and they're also very appreciative." Now, to return to the question of the significance of habitus for patient-centered care, recall that the first pillar of patient-centered care was to understand the patient in her biopsychosocial context. So we are experiencing individuals, we're not an object, we're not a disease, right? Not a condition. So providers are called upon with this principle of patient-centered care to learn how a patient interprets illness, the significance that illness holds for the patient, and the culturally determined norms and beliefs that she uses to understand, explain, and describe that illness. But as we saw with the interaction with the quotes that I showed you, one clear barrier to this is that providers bring their own habitus, their own assumptions about how the world should work into their interactions with their patients. So in our study, we found that all of our physician participants, like Dr. Barrow, held highly ingrained and taken for granted expectations of the CHC elements their patients, at minimum, should have to help move the interaction forward, to get things done. We argue that these expectations around responsibility and good patienthood are generated from providers' habitus, which in turn is rooted in their stratified social experiences as racialized, class, and gendered individuals. It also comes out of their clinical training and their socialization as physicians and as healthcare providers, and it is also shaped by the organizational context in which they work, by the hospitals and the internal culture of the places where they work. So even with the example of Luis and Anna, who clearly demonstrate quite a lot of agency in their healthcare interaction, it's actually Dr. Barrow who determines what cultural resources or what kinds of CHC hold value in the first place. Through their expectations for the kinds of CHC patients have or need to have in order to optimize the clinical encounter, providers possess unequal power in that they get to set the rules of the game. So there are two conceptual contributions that I believe habitus makes to analyzing healthcare interactions. First, as we saw with Luis, because of habitus, the kinds of attributes that define being an activated and engaged and savvy patient aren't simply skills that people can just pick up. Habitus is the product of one's social experiences, and these social experiences are highly stratified. So this, in turn, means that the kinds of actions that people engage in, the questions that they have, and the kinds of information that they want or don't want when faced with illness, how they go about managing their illness, or even if they think about the illness as something to manage or whether it's just something you bear and that you put up with, all of these are socially stratified as well. So the second contribution that I think this notion of habitus makes is that provider habitus has an impact in that it shapes expectations about patients' responsibilities and behaviors. And again, this means that the provider possesses disproportionate power to set the rules of the interaction and to state what kinds of CHC are valued and what kinds of gains a patient is going to have who successfully deploys cultural health capital. So this patient-centered charge to get to know the patient in her biopsychosocial context ignores that this context is actually laid on top of an already existing landscape that's structured and shaped by power and inequality. So then let me turn to the second vignette. So we have Clarice and her cardiologist, Dr. Crawford. Clarice is 72 years old. At the time of our interview, she was 72 years old. She's African American. And she's seeing Dr. Crawford because she needs to have knee surgery done. Mm-hmm. And because she has a pre-existing heart condition, she needs to get medical clearance from a cardiologist in order to be able to be clear to go to get surgery. So on the particular day that we met Clarice in the clinic, her blood pressure was actually high. And so here's an excerpt from their exchange. Clarice, I think the pain from the knee, I think the abnormally high blood pressure is due to this pain. And Dr. Crawford replies, you know, before I used to wonder when people told me that, but then I had a guy come in here who had a bad knee, and when he's sitting down, his blood pressure is low, and as soon as he walks and gets up on the table, it goes sky high because it hurts so bad. Is that the thing with you too? Yes, because usually my blood pressure is good. I'm just looking back to like when Dr. W. has seen you in the clinic. And you're right, like when you were seen in April, your blood pressure was 110 over 66, which is very good blood pressure. And Clarice replies, yeah, that's why I think it's the pain. So in this scenario, Dr. Crawford is weighing the blood pressure reading that was done by the nurse in the clinic against Clarice's own understanding of what she considers her normal blood pressure to be and her understanding of why her current blood pressure that day in the clinic is higher. Clarice's explanation made sense to Dr. Crawford, and Clarice was clear for surgery without any additional testing or delay. As Dr. Crawford elaborated separately to us in her interview, quote, that's why I talk to these guys, because they know a lot about themselves. I don't think she has any medical training, but people figure stuff out, and I think that helps. So I really love patients like that, because it's much more of a give and take. It's not just me saying, okay, here's what you need to do. So again, to bring this back to patient-centered care, recall that the second central ingredient of PCC was to try to achieve this shared understanding of the patient's perspective and concerns of what the clinical condition involved and what the treatment options might be. Yet in our study, we found that shared understanding was actually often equated to shared biomedical understanding. So instances of and efforts to build shared understanding were most often predicated on patients sharing providers' biomedical understandings of the clinical condition rather than the converse or coming to some hybridized understanding. So in this vignette with Clarice and Dr. Crawford, Clarice's understanding of the situation made sense biomedically and made sense to Dr. Crawford and her existing understanding of what causes high blood pressure. So this shared biomedical understanding, obviously it facilitates really efficient information exchange, but it also communicates something about Clarice's medical sophistication, and it increases the personal regard that Dr. Crawford has for Clarice. And for this patient-provider relationship and for others in our study, we saw that providers' favorable impressions of patients then generated cascades of additional actions that led to more satisfying and more, in fact, more patient-centered care. So to go back to these two vignettes that I've presented, so in both the examples of Clarice and Dr. Crawford, as well as Luis and Dr. Barrow, the attention and care that providers may offer may actually constitute rewards given in response to how well the patient has displayed and deployed the repertoire of skills. That is, their interactions can be seen as social transactions, and CHC underscores the significance of the work that these cultural resources do in these transactions. So if you have a sense of initiative, you have the ability to take action to manage your health, you have medical knowledge, you have health literacy, all of these things about being an activated and engaged patient can directly facilitate communication and appropriate treatment, but it also indirectly and positively influences providers' perceptions of patients. And in turn, it generates sort of these cascades of extra treatment, extra care, extra attention, extra time that can often enhance outcomes. So in this sense, CHC functions as symbolic capital. That is a kind of capital that's accorded approval and rewarded. And it's this dual nature of CHC as both instrumental and symbolic capital, as having direct effects as well as indirect effects, that I think offers a conceptual elaboration of what it takes to achieve patient-centered care. Let's see, how are we doing on time here? Okay, all right. So I want to turn to my final vignette. So this is, it involves Iosefa and her cardiologist, Dr. DeLuca. Iosefa, she is from Samoa. She's in her 50s, and she was diagnosed with coronary heart disease about a year before we met her, and she's been seeing Dr. DeLuca for much of that interim year. Iosefa, this was a regular sort of, you know, check-in for her. And on that clinic day, she admitted that she's not very compliant with her medication regimen because it gives her terrible headaches. And here's what she says. Sometimes I feel I don't know if I should do it. Take the medicine or should I leave it? When I take my medicine, sometimes I feel worse and then I say, forget it. I'm not listening to what the doctors say. To tell you the truth, I get confused. What should I do? Is the doctor right or am I right? Should I take it or should I not? So what happens in their appointment is that Dr. DeLuca really tries to foster Iosefa's understanding of her illness and her symptoms in this like markedly extremely collaborative kind of way. So she explains to Iosefa that the goal of the medication is to actually preserve her heart function rather than to cure it. It's to preserve her heart function and not to cure the coronary heart disease. She reviews the medication and actually physically goes through each one of the pill bottles that Iosefa has brought with her, and she identifies what she thinks is probably the cause of the headaches, and she puts a big black X on the pill bottle to signify to Iosefa she should stop taking that medication. And she really listens to Iosefa during this appointment about, you know, when do the headaches come on, when are you taking this medicine, when are you taking that medicine. And then she's able, through that process, to figure out this alternative medication that Iosefa should try that hopefully will alleviate the headaches and prevent the headaches. And she also gives Iosefa a bunch of different strategies, you know, timing the medications in a different kind of way, using over-the-counter medications when, you know, she starts feeling a headache coming on, and taking medications right before she, you know, does something that requires physical exertion. And she, at the end of the clinic appointment, she says, okay, these are all the things that we're going to try. I want you to commit, make a commitment to me that you're going to try these things for 1 week, and then we'll see how you do. We're going to check in by phone in a week and see how you do. So at an interview 1 week after her visit with Dr. DeLuca, Iosefa reported that her headaches were indeed better, and she was able to take her medications as prescribed. So here she says, I have control of the medicine now. I know if I control the medication now, then it'll be easy to control in the future. And Dr. DeLuca, in her follow-up interview with us, described this remarkable difference that she saw in her patient. Quote, Iosefa left me a message the other day about a pharmacy problem with one of her medications, and I didn't recognize her at first. She has become much more articulate and precise about relating the issues to me. So I want to use this vignette of Iosefa and Dr. DeLuca to reflect on the third pillar of patient-centered care, which is this notion of shared power and shared responsibility. So healthcare is envisioned as this collaboration between the patient and the provider, rather than just the provider giving directions and the patient receiving them and complying with them. So it's the shift from like an asymmetric top-down model to one, something that seems much more equitable and egalitarian and collaborative. And indeed, I think it's probably safe to say that looking at the interaction between EOCEFA and Dr. DeLuca, it is an interaction that we can see some element of shared power and shared responsibility. Obviously, there's a real instrumental benefit to this. You know, EOCEFA's headaches were in better control. She no longer suffered from those side effects that caused her to avoid medication. You know, because she's taking the medications as prescribed, her condition is going to be better. Her overall heart function is going to be better. And the long-term consequences of her condition are going to be reduced. And it also, obviously, you know, it engenders, this is sort of a pivotal step in their relationship for the two of them. And EOCEFA talks about where she felt like she's in control and sort of empowered in a sense. And in many cases, as far as we can tell from our interview with her, this was one of the first times that she really felt like this about her healthcare and about her relationship, with a healthcare provider. And in this, like, you could see Dr. DeLuca sort of actively cultivating EOCEFA's sort of ability to weigh the costs and benefits of this action versus that action. And importantly, it has these spillover benefits for her, too. She's able to take kind of what some of the skills that she learned from Dr. DeLuca and use it to negotiate and manage a problem that she had with the pharmacy, right? But on the other hand, Dr. DeLuca's actions and talk explicitly induce particular types of patient behaviors that the physician finds valuable. And it communicates not only the type of actor a patient can be, but the type of actor that patient ought to be. So a patient-centered approach doesn't necessarily relieve the asymmetry of the interaction. Rather, asymmetry is being accomplished and being reinforced in a different kind of way. So all along, I'm trying to use CHC as this concept that really tries to interrogate what PC, this egalitarian model that PCC is really promising. And we keep trying to point to the underlying architecture of inequality on top of which PCC, this new model of providing care, is being laid on top of. Okay. So to start summing things up, I just want to reiterate that recognizing and responding to individual characteristics, because that's really what patient-centered care is meant to do. It's meant to talk about there is no one universal, one-size-fits-all kind of medical care. We have to look at each patient as an individual, and we have to tailor medical care to that particular individual. And so it's a really attractive model, and it's actually a fairly intuitive way to think about building a therapeutic relationship, a relationship in which care is being offered and received, and in which we, as individual patients, want to receive care, right? We don't want the one-size-fits-all model. But we believe, however, that CHC helps us to understand and helps to illuminate these interactional dynamics that precede, underlie, and go beyond PCC. So CHC emphasizes that cultural resources and attributes influence patients' and providers' mutually shaped abilities to achieve PCC. And it all happens through this process of evaluations that providers engage in, and which I try to illustrate with the three vignettes. So CHC, again, to reiterate, it's conceptualized as a means of exchange, and these healthcare interactions are kinds of social transactions. And so, therefore, the effects of social inequalities like race, class, gender, and other markers of social status are going to be reflected in the amounts and the kinds of CHC that we all have access to and the extent to which we're able to deploy them successfully in a healthcare interaction and the extent to which actually providers recognize or are willing to give you quote-unquote credit for the kinds of resources and skills and assets that you have. So I started out this talk by pointing out some of the opportunities we have as we move forward with the Affordable Care Act, because it is a pretty significant opportunity. And in particular, you know, there's a really explicit aim of the ACA to improve care for our most vulnerable and sickest populations. And yet at the same time, as I've tried to show, there are these really strong currents that keep running against the achievement of health equity and health care equity. And some of these are actually embedded, as I was trying to argue, within the ACA itself and in the ways in which it tries to engage with the sort of this discourse of virtuous patienthood.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.